Welcome to the Heart Journey podcast. Today we have Dr. Everett Worthington. Yes, his name sounds familiar. One, he's been on the Heart Journey podcast before, and he is like the forgiveness guru. Okay. Like he is the forgiveness researcher. He's created the REACH program to help with forgiveness. He is amazing. He is so well-studied, well-written, and he's with us today. And y'all, we're going to go so deep. Have you experienced a tragedy that left you questioning God or left you questioning if you should have done something different? Have you gone to really deep places of pain and hurt where you had a sense of survivor's guilt? Someone died by suicide, something terrible happened to someone in your sphere of influence. Oh, this is for you. Listen, it's going to be so good. I am so, so glad to have Dr. Everett Worthington back on the Heart Journey podcast with Dr. Barbara. Welcome, Dr. Worthington.
Hey, good to be with you, Dr. Barbara.
Now, Dr. Worthington, I want to tell the audience that you and I had an after chat after our last podcast, and we realized, I might start crying already, we realized we had some really deep and profound experiences in common, and we also realized, wow, we didn't get into self-forgiveness, and so we thought we would podcast again and talk about these topics.
Yeah, good. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. And both of us are psychologists and both of us are PhD therapists, and we've been through a lot of hard things with our family. And you're primarily a researcher of forgiveness. And yet we discovered we had this shared experience of suicide in our immediate family. Mm-hmm. And yeah. So I was wondering if we could get into what we went through, because last time we talked about the murder of your mom, mm-hmm. and today we're going to talk about suicide for both your family member and my family member, what we went through, the process we went through, and how that ties to forgiveness and how that ties to the overcoming life. Like, is there a Sunday possible after we go through that Thursday, Friday mm-hmm. with the suicide? And so I thought we could get into this because it applies so much to those hard to answer questions, kind of the theodicy, even why is there evil on the earth if God is so good? And what's it like to be on the inside of one of these stories? So can you share your story or whatever else you want to begin
sure.
with?
Yeah. So you mentioned the murder of my mother in Knoxville, Tennessee. I live in Richmond, Virginia. My brother actually discovered her body and really, I think, had a traumatic reaction to that because it was a very brutal murder and blood all over the place. And he walked in with his son on New Year's Day and, discovered the body. And so I think that was really hard for him. I didn't really know how hard that was for him until almost 10 years later. And we were, I was down in Knoxville doing a conference, and I went by, as I always did when I went to Knoxville, and Mike and I went out to a all-you-can-eat Chinese restaurant. And, it's the way families do. So it turns out, often I went with his wife and his son, but mm-hmm. this particular time, neither one could go. And so Mike and I went alone and had this... I think the best adult conversation wow. we ever had. But in the course of that, he mentioned that he was having a lot of trouble emotionally, that he mm-hmm. would get depressed. He would go into his room on Saturdays, sometime pull the blinds closed wow. and sit in the dark for 12 hours and just be depressed. And as I listened to him, and he talked about how he had these images, memories of seeing Mama's body there, and he just couldn't get them out of his mind. And they would come back in the middle of his work day, and, you know, at just times, you know, enter into his life. And as I listened to this, I said, Mike, you know, it sounds like you might have a post-traumatic stress problem.
Yes.
And you know, I said, you know, you probably need to see a counselor about this. And he goes, I'm not going to any therapist. No, I'm not going to any shrink. So this is what he says to his shrink brother, right? So this right away engages me back in, I was 4 years younger than him, and it was almost as if I was back in high school. I'd just been challenged by my younger brother, and so you know, I held it together. I didn't decompensate right there. I said, Mike, so if this hasn't changed in almost 10 years, it probably isn't going to change unless you do something different. And he got really upset, and he pointed his finger at me. His lip was trembling. He goes, I'm not going to any blankety blank shrink, and I don't want to hear any more about it. Well, now you might think me as a therapist, as a, you know, mature guy at that point, that I would use my therapeutic training and I would realize this is resistance and I don't want to tackle this head on. Let's kind of skirt this. Let's come at it from a different angle. Let's just not continue down this path. Did I do that? No, not a chance. I was right back there as a teenager, hormone crazed, challenged by his little brother. And so I said, you know, in response to his, I don't want to hear any more about it. It was like, well, whatever. Yeah, very mature response. And I didn't bring it up again.
It's funny. Yeah, those child parts come out with our families, and that is like the hardest hurdle to overcome with our child parts and overcoming those roles. Yeah, I understand.
So, you know, within about 3 months, though, Kirby and I were over in Europe. I was on my way to visiting professorship at the University of Cambridge, and we were in Paris at the time. We got a phone call, you know, saying, call me immediately, to the woman that was kind of managing Kirby's schedule. And so I called her up, and, you know, and I put Kirby on the phone, and she listens and just goes, oh no. And she says, your brother just committed suicide this morning. And, you know, so I took the phone and you know, talked about that. But so there I was, you know, kind of dealing with this problem that had just kind of come out of the blue. I felt really guilty about not using the knowledge that God had given me in order to be able to, you know, deal with this. And, you know, and so I felt terrible. I just kind of walked around for like 2 days in northern Paris and stomping on children in the street, basically, just not knowing what I'm doing. And it was pretty unsettling. So, you know, that was the beginning of it. It was just, you know, a period of I don't know what's happened and I'm trying to get my feet under me.
Yes. Thank you so much for sharing that. And talk about, you know, there's some things you just don't want to be away from home when you have to hear them. It seems extra awful that you were traveling and in a place that's supposed to be lovely, dreamy, you know?
Right. Yeah.
I'd like to tell my story to that part, if that's okay. And I'll just kind of match different phases of your story to my story.
Yeah.
There are some similarities. You know, first of all, I'm a psychologist, right? And My dad and I had had a real ruptured relationship, but a year before he actually passed, we had a reconciliation, and I was hoping he would move because he was really choosing the drug and alcohol and kind of hippie life in the island. I'm partly from Hawaii with some of my family, and it was just too scary for him to come back. He as it turned out, he just had so much PTSD, and I think he got a hold of some. I think he got a hold of some bad drugs. Anyway, he didn't sleep for days. He was clearly having a psychotic break. I actually was trying to witness to him every day and also trying to get him to go to the VA, but he is, six hours time zone behind me. Right. And so, and my mother had just found out she had colon cancer stage 3. Wow. And was going to have to go have surgery. So it's Friday night. I'm going to bed. I'm laying in bed. I had addressed my dad so many times. He was talking about the Vietnam War. He was talking about abuse he went through. And he was also talking about the traumas he went through with the intimate partner violence and rejection with my mother. And I knew he was having a psychotic break, but I've seen my dad break before, not this bad, but I've seen him break and come back. And there was no indication. He wasn't talking about suicide or anything. Anyway, I was laying in bed. It was 11:30 at night. I was at my mother's house. And my mother and I also had a lot of difficulty in our relationship. And I was at her house. We were having surgery the next day. I was like, the phone rang. I saw it was my dad. I was like, I've given him so much time today. Even though I need to be here for my mom right now, I'm just going to go to sleep. And that was the last phone call.
Wow.
That I didn't take. Yeah. And I didn't hear from him for like 2 days. And I thought, oh, he must have gotten better. Like, he sometimes would lose it and kind of get better. Right. Mm-hmm. He was scary. But the next call I got when I was home was from my stepbrother sobbing. And my dad had shot himself, and I didn't take the last call, and it happened right after that.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So very, very similar. And the questions of, I should have called the police. I should have seen this. And then as a Christian, I wanted to ask if you had some of this. As a Christian, there's also, I should have discerned this.
Mm. Yeah, I wish I were together enough to have said that, but I was just like, how can this happen? I don't understand this. It was just kind of disconnected, and just raw emotion everywhere, but not a lot of thought. And it was probably the third day before I actually had any thoughts about this. And, and when it happened, we were in northern Paris, so we were up near Montmartre, mm-hmm. staying at a hostel. And I decided, I got up at like 6, and I was like, I'm going to go for a run. And so I went out running, and there was the steps to Montmartre, that go up. I don't know how many there are, but it was many, many wonderful steps. And so I run up the steps, and I get to the top, and I look out. There's this balcony that looks out over Paris. And this day was kind of super foggy.
Okay.
But I'm up, like, above the fog, mm-hmm. and I'm looking down at Paris shrouded in fog, and there are all these churches where the steeple is kind of popping up through the fog.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's just like a metaphor for mm-hmm. the way I've been feeling. My whole existence has been a fog, and I will have this moment of clarity that, pops up and just disappears down into the fog again. And and realizing that, I turned and I looked at the cathedral that was up there at the top of Montmartre, and it's the Cathedral of the Sacred Heart. Well, it turns out, they were cleaning that. And so the doors were open, which at 6 o'clock in the morning, they're never open. And so I walked over there and I stood outside looking down, you know, toward the altar. And if people have been there, you know that there's this big painting of the Jesus with the Sacred Heart that's up on the wall there, you know, behind the altar. And I looked at that, and I think my first real coherent thought was, you know, I am not the first person to ever go through this, you know, and Jesus is with me with this. And, you know, I need to just, you know, confess my, you know, my failures to him and just accept the comfort from that. And I felt up here, you know, a feeling of peace that kind of, you know, came over me and settled me for a little while. Now, I'm no place near, you know, finished dealing with this. This is just the initial, oh, finally, I feel a tiny bit of clarity out of the fog. And so anyway, that was then kind of my next step in progressing.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. That's beautiful. And seeing those steeples and you know, we're looking for that. We're looking for clarity amongst the fog of life. We're looking like we have access to the Holy of Holies because the veil's been ripped, but we're looking for how to move into that and live from that place. And our flesh is so distracting.
Yep.
So we quickly booked tickets to Hawaii, flew over, and began to, my dad didn't have much, but began to organize what little he had. And, you know, I was the executor. He had, you know, just really a motorcycle was the only thing that he really loved that he had to his name, and sent some stuff back to my brother. But one of the things that I did that was kind of like moment would be Waipio Valley, that there's this valley.
Right.
Yeah.
I've hiked down in that.
Yeah. So we used to camp down in there and boat down in there and do different things. And when I lived there, and I went to high school there for part of my high school. Anyway, my dad lived there for decades, and we got some people together. My stepbrother is local, and then some other locals, because you don't really want to hike in there too far if you're not local. You just want to be really careful. And you know, it's like a level 10 hike because the path keeps disappearing. But we hiked all the way back. And even one of the women who said she'd lived down there, she's like, we don't need to go that far. We don't need to go. And we're like, no, we're going all the way in. So we went, and you might have done this, but we went all the way down to the double waterfall, and it felt really sacred because, you know, that's the King's Path, and it's a very royal and sacred place to the Hawaiian people. And I knew that that would honor my father because he identified so much with the Hawaiian culture. And there was still a lot to process, but that was like my moment of, I did something honorable. Mm. You know, there's something honorable in this for him that I've done. It felt, cause you feel so powerless, you know, mm-hmm. you know? And so like you went for a run, I went to on this hike. Anyway, I put a lot of his ashes down there, and that was super good.
Kind of like offering this up on an altar, you know, to the Lord.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. There were other pieces to it as well. And the Lord was in it all. But then I came back and was practicing as a psychologist in private practice, and also some in the schools and in community psychology. And there was this feeling like, I can't really talk about this with hardly anyone. because it's so stigmatizing and because of what I do. But there was like this feeling like I want to scream. It was suicide. Like it felt so violent to have happened. And I love Kenneth Pargaman's idea of the sacred core. It definitely felt like it was in the sacred core. Like Satan came in and slipped someone out from the sacred core, because these are people who, like your nuclear family you grew up with, you're like, you know, you're praying for them to come to Christ, and you're praying like, anyway, so there was still a lot to process. And, but I want to hear more of yours, and, and I'm sure we'll get to survivor's guilt a little bit more.
Yeah. So Kirby and I went on and went to Cambridge, and, you know, I spent about 3.5 months there. And during that time, I was writing a couple of books, but I was spending most of my time actually thinking about self-forgiveness. We had done 2 or 3 intervention studies to help people forgive people who had addiction problems and things like that. But as I thought through the steps that we had used at, you know, in those studies, I was like, that's not helping me that much. You know, I'm still struggling with this. And it kind of surprised me, because when my mom was murdered, I was able to forgive the young man who did this very quickly. And yet here I was, and it was 3, 4, 5 months later, and I'm still struggling with this. And I was reading a book, and it was by Pumla Gobodo-Madikizela. So she is a South African psychologist, psychoanalyst, who was on the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And I had met her at a Harvard conference that I'd organized back in, you know, a few years earlier. And so I got her book when it came out. And it was an account of her dealing with one of the chief architects of the apartheid inequity system, whose name was Eugene de Kock. Eugene de Kock was the kind of chief police enforcer. He had, by his own account, murdered over 100 people and ordered many others to be killed. And so he had been, you know, taken in as a criminal after this. And so Pumla was interviewing him on behalf of the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Yeah.
So here I was, and I'm thinking about, you know, what if I were interviewing him? And what if he said to me, which he never said to Pumla, but what if he said to me, you know, I've done a lot of bad things in my life, but I forgive myself. What would I say? Well, I would say, you can't do that. You know, that's just not right. And I realized at that point that just jumping into thinking about self-forgiveness is premature. And so I thought, well, what's necessary? Well, you know, one thing that was necessary is go to God with this. And so I felt like, okay, I went to God right up there at Sacré-Cœur. And, you know, so, and I felt like God had forgiven me, but I still was very troubled. And so I thought, well, there's got to be other things. And so, you know, I thought, well, I probably did some harm as a result of this, and I need to make right that harm, but I have no idea how to possibly do that because Mike's dead. How do you make that right again? And then the other thing that you need to do, you know, I needed to do was to deal with maybe the damage psychologically that I had done to myself, you know, the moral injury of doing something that, looking back, I considered that's not the way that I should have done. It was something wrong that I did, was to get triggered by an old, you know, high school hormone. And so I realized that the process of self-forgiveness, was incomplete the way that I tried to approach it at that point. And I tried to work through those steps and then, try to forgive myself and then deal with, being able to accept myself that here I am, a psychologist. I thought I would not do that. A Christian. I thought I would not do that. Who am I? What am I doing? I am just not able to accept myself, basically, although I might get to the place someday when I forgive myself. So I think I got through a lot of the beginning part, but I never could get to the place of how do I make this right, or try to make this right in some way, because I could never make it right. I could never bring him back and deal with the resistance in a way that was more professionally and personally sensitive.
Yes. Yes. We just podcasted on what to do when we're making amends, because we have the ministry of reconciliation that Christ makes things whole. Right. And we're joined into that ministry of making things whole. And what does that look like, when we can't go back? Also, I want to add for me, because some of this is probably survivor's guilt for you, and then other parts are really looking at how I wish I would have pressed more, and tried to help more. One of the things that helped me to forgive myself, and yours might go in a different direction than mine, but it's all useful, right?
Yeah.
Because I was reading too. I don't even remember what I was reading, but I was just reading anything to have points of identification because I didn't feel like I could talk to very many people about it. Most people haven't gone through with the suicide of a parent. And so I remember thinking about grief and reading about grief and survivor's guilt and that it's normal. And that I began to consider that this survivor's guilt is a lot based on this sense of control, that I might have more control than what I do, because I wish I would have called the police. And then there's the thought, well, what if he would have shot the police? What if more people would have died? And so one of the things that really helped me with forgiving myself was this thought of, I feel guilty and that's normal, but it doesn't mean I'm guilty. That super helped me just to normalize survivor's guilt, the coulda, woulda, shoulda, because there's a part of it for me that I thought, well, it's kind of like bargaining. It's kind of like the bargaining piece of grief, that if I would have done this differently, maybe it would have had a different outcome. And I don't know that, I don't know that. Anyway, I want to hear what helped you and where you're at, but that's a piece that helped me. I do try to tell my story while honoring my parents, because I know they tried. There was a lot of mess I grew up in, but they, especially at the beginning, really tried. And that's another thing I try to do is give them honor for what they did try to do. What about you? What has helped you with this?
Well, the struggle that I had of not knowing what I could do was really a roadblock. And it turns out that, I went back to the U.S. and so I'd been chair of the department, and I had a year of half pay as a leave after that. So the first half was at Cambridge, but now I'm back at VCU. And, I decided that I had not gone to see Mike's widow, Mike's, wife and kid. And so Kirby and I drove down to Knoxville to see her. And so, we had a nice talk with her. And then she said, Mike left a suicide note, and it was to you. It wasn't to me or David. And I was like, oh, shoot. Because I had forgotten that, I knew that, but it was like, nope, that's too threatening because I felt like that's going to be a condemnation. I just better block that out of my mind. So at any rate, so she, Charlene said, well, I think the Oak Ridge, which is near Knoxville, the Oak Ridge police have that note and you just need to go and pick it up. Now, of course, being a man of valor, I just rushed to Oak Ridge to pick that up, right? No, I did not do that. I said, Kirby, would you go to Oak Ridge and pick this up? And so my wife, she goes while I run errands. So then she brings the note back and hands it to me, and I take it and literally I can't even read it because I'm shaking so much. And what it said was, it said, I know you'll keep your head in the middle of all this crisis, and I have left our finances in a terrible state, and I wonder if you will just straighten those finances out for me. And so I was like, finally, I get to do something, that to make up for some of this. And so, I was able to spend quite a bit of time trying to help them straighten out their finances. And that kind of released a kind of a dam that, allowed the kind of progress to flow. So that summer, I was down at Florida writing a book, and I decided, I've never really addressed, I've done all of these preliminary steps of going to God, dealing with the social consequences, dealing with the personal consequences. I've never really addressed actually forgiving myself for this. And so I decided to use that Reach Forgiveness model, to try to think through that. And the way that I did it was every day I went on two walks to break up the morning and the afternoon. And so I just would go over to the beach and I would, walk and I would think through one of those steps. So like, R is recall the hurt, and I would try to just process what happened, and then E, empathize with myself as I would with somebody, would empathize with somebody else who had gone through this, and A, the third day, give an altruistic gift of forgiveness, and one I don't deserve, but still, the same altruistic gift I would give to somebody else who's done wrong. And then C, commit to the forgiveness you experience. And that day, that once I'd gotten through the first three and I was working on the commit, I, saw these pieces of rock and coral that probably some kid had made into a little castle. And it, because the tide had come in and come out, it had kind of covered it with sand. And I was there in another sequence of tide, and I stood there watching that as the tide would come in and go out. And this time the sand would get washed away every single time that it, came, that a wave came in and out, that a little more sand would be taken away. And I thought, that's the way that I feel. I feel that I've done these things. This is my commitment, that to the experience that I've had, to see that metaphor of that dirt being washed away time and time again, so that later I can remember that picture and hold on to that whenever I doubt. So really that allowed me to make a decision that I'm going to treat myself now as a valued and valuable person, as someone created in God's image, you know, and I don't have to keep beating myself up for this because, you know, psychologically as well as spiritually as well as socially, you know, I've been now, you know, washed clean. So, you know, so that, you know, really kind of completed my experience. There are another couple of steps that in our, my little six step model, but which is one is self-acceptance of being a person who would do this. Mm-hmm. And that was a little more struggle even than self-forgiveness. And then committing not to do that again, but to be a little more sensitive, less defensive, you know, even when my buttons get pushed, to try to recognize, hey, my buttons are pushed, you know, my brother installed my button that, you know, maybe somebody else might install somebody else's, another button, but I got to recognize that and not get triggered into that again.
You know what I love about your share with this is that, the honesty. We love to write this narrative of our life in a way that we're the hero, covering up the shame we feel underneath for not being the hero. Like kind of like a defensive narrative that we like to write. And this past year in particular, the Lord's taken me so deep. It's been I've had 4 years of like a stripping the Lord's taken me through that have been, in the year Uzziah died, I saw the Lord, right? It was like when the stability ended, I saw the Lord. And, you know, it was hard. There's a lot of lament, but I saw the Lord. And in that, he really allowed me the gift of humility to really look at myself and to press in. And to look at my own faults and where I needed to make amends. And there's such freedom and cleanliness, like David talks about in the Psalms, like the clean heart. I think it's
51.
I knew it was 50s. Yes. And so Jesus has made us clean, but we don't want to spiritually bypass those pieces of looking at ourselves. And I love that you said, even though my brother installed the button, I'm still responsible for how I react to it. And this past year has been a lot of that for me. You know, I've realized, I talked about my parents a little bit, who tried so hard. I think at one point they kind of gave up, but they tried to push down their traumatic past, and it just exploded everywhere, but they tried. And so I really have had to look at where my faults have come from that. I have a lot of faults that have come from that, and where I can suck up all the air out of the room or make it all about my needs. And, you know, these things show up and they're a part of us. And the most courageous thing is looking at it and beginning to make amends. And I honor you for that so much, Dr. Worthington.
I was just blessed that, you know, Mike had left that note. Otherwise, I might still be just wandering around, you know. But, you know, God's good all the time.
He is. Yeah. He is good. What I love about this talk is that I think it applies to not just tragic deaths, suicide, but also when we feel like in some way something has happened in our family on our watch or in our domain on our watch. And this, how do I walk through this? How do I walk through whether it's like false guilt and survivor's guilt or a mixture, because some of that guilt is always probably going to be survivor's guilt, you know, and then there could be real pieces, you know. Certainly I have walked through with my dad after having just a reconciliation, all like, oh my gosh, how could I have done things differently? Even with my mom, we had 2 years where we didn't speak and it was my boundary. And I finally, this past year, got into a place where I was like, you know, I needed to learn to set boundaries with her, but that was too much. That was too much because she, you know, she died young. And that was time I didn't have, and I could have handled it differently. So it's so important for us to humble ourselves, not over apologize, but also not under apologize, and then make those living amends, be a different person, right? Because I bet this didn't just affect you with Mike, but I bet it's affected you in how you walk forward in lots of ways, and also risk inventories and how you treat those. Like, I speak on suicide and deal with suicide. I had a suicidal client this week, right? So we deal with this a lot, and it's impacted us. I bet we move forward with even more integrity, don't you think?
Yeah, I'd like to believe that.
Yeah.
You know, I had an additional struggle I didn't even realize I had. And that was, I actually had gotten pretty angry with God. Mm. I didn't know it. You know, I just, you know, I read every morning. And so I would, some mornings, you know, I read psychology, and some mornings I read, you know, scripture or, you know, or Christian writings. And what happened over time is I just went to psychology, and scripture and, you know, Christian writings were just going away.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that, but I was out at Biola University in Los Angeles, and I was at a meeting that we went to every year. And the speaker was Maureen Miner, who is a psychoanalytically informed therapist from Sydney, Australia. And so she gave her talk. And so, you know, we all went back to the hotel, and I happened to arrive at the same time as Maureen. And we went around and we kind of got in the elevator together, you know, they'd put all the people at the conference on the same floor. And so, you know, we're riding up to the sixth floor, and Maureen says to me, "So, Ev, I understand that a couple of years ago, your brother committed suicide. How are you doing with that?" And I said, "Fine." And so this is like a hint, you know, if you ever find yourself in a locked box with a psychoanalyst and they ask you an emotionally loaded question, probably "fine" is not your best solution, because she just kind of went, "Really?" and didn't say anything, you know, and I'm like, you know, feeling all of a sudden like I need to talk. And so I said, "Well, I'm kind of fine. I mean, I'm pretty much fine." And, you know, and I start to try to talk. And as I did, I almost could see myself outside of myself watching myself going, "That guy is angry and bitter at God." Mm-hmm. And I didn't want that, you know? And so, you know, I was able, because of her just being willing to listen to me and let me reflect on, you know, my experience, I was able to just go, "I'm going back to my room. I'm going to get down on my knees, and I'm going to, you know, try to start making this relationship restored with the Lord again." Yeah. So, you know, so that was kind of a major turning point. And it was quite separate from the self-forgiveness, you know. Yeah. It was a kind of a parallel spiritual experience of a struggle with God.
Yeah. Yeah, and we do have spiritual struggles. You know, Christians have spiritual struggles. We know that's true from the research. And we know a third of the Bible is lament. Right. And yeah. Being with God in those hard places. So I had a couple little, processes as well that were separate from the survivor's guilt and feeling guilty piece. Coulda, shoulda, woulda. One was, where's my father's eternal reality? And, the Lord spoke to me. And you know how you talked about you had a grace gift when your mom was murdered? I felt like this has been a grace gift. The Lord said, that's a no fishing zone for you. I really felt like he spoke in my heart. I saw a no fishing sign. He said, there's a no fishing zone. You had your dad on this earth. You'll have your eternal family. And then these bigger realities I hold, you know, and I know there's debate about restoration of all things and annihilation and the other one, you know, and I have studied those. I'm familiar with those. But as far as my dad's eternal reality, the Lord's, I just have had to not fish there. Because humanly speaking, it's just too much. It's just too much. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's see there. That was a hard one to talk about, I can tell, because I forgot the second point. I'll see if you have anything to respond, and I'll see if I can remember my second point, but I probably dissociated it a little bit.
Well, I like the metaphor because, you know, we want to be in control, mm-hmm. and we have this illusion that we somehow are in control, but, you know, when we run against these hard things, you know, we have to realize, you know, I don't have the control that I thought I had. Yeah. The Lord is in control, and I am not his boss. I can't second guess his decisions. You know, my job is just to trust and love and, you know, and let God be God and not yeah. have to try to intrude on that.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. I did remember the second one. The other piece was, God, how could this happen? Mm-hmm. You know, and it goes back to the discernment. How did I not have discernment to it's exactly control. How did mm-hmm. I have the discernment to not pray this away or bind this up or whatever it is, you know? And I do feel like the Lord spoke to me, you know, in my pneumatological imagination. I felt like he said, because I said, God, how did this happen in my times with him? I really was grappling with him in my private times with him. And he said, the enemy snuck in and took him, mm-hmm. you know, and that now when I think I hear things, I always want to align it to scripture. Right. And that is, you know, the enemy comes to kill, steal and destroy. And he's a murderer from the beginning. He's a liar. And I know we all pass away, but certainly death by self is not the way to do it. So it does align it with scripture. And look at, from the outside in, there's so many things I thought, oh, I couldn't go through that. Like I've had a full-term stillborn, suicide of my dad. I've been through unwanted divorce. And then there's all the traumas I went through in childhood. But there were things as a Christian, I was like, oh, I couldn't go through that. And then you go through it and God's there. And I think sometimes outside looking in, we're like, how could a just God let that happen? And we do ask those questions. If we're honest, Dr. W, we do, right? but you and I are both looking back on this and seeing where God has been there. And it's like the footprints poem. That's why we love that poem so much, because it's so obvious he was there and he carried us. He carried you. He carried me. In these places where trauma hit that sacred core, and where we felt like we could have, should have, would have done something more, especially because of our field, and this tragedy happened. And yet he's walked us through. And you and I are both helping other people. I've written on suicide. I've spoken on it. You know, I'm comfortable talking about it. And you're using your trauma as a gift as well.
Yeah. I like that we had two different stories on this, yeah. you know, because it's kind of the way that brackets the way that we deal with these things. You know, you stayed engaged with God in conversation and, you know, and asking questions and, you know, and I was like, Nope, don't think about it. Let's, you know, just, I got cold instead of hot about this. And I think those are both human ways that yeah. you know, we deal with these things. And what's important, I think, is that God can make that breakthrough, that can talk with you, can, you know, provide, you know, Marine Minor to go, you know, knock, knock. Hey, you know, really? Oh, you're really doing fine, huh? You know, in that kind of gentle confrontation that, that, you know, broke through my coldness and allowed that reconnection.
Beautiful. Would you, I think this has touched, you know, struck a chord with those who have these traumas in their sacred core, this place where safety has been pierced with someone we love or even ourselves, you know, how could this happen? And I think it's going to be a powerful conversation for folks to listen to. Would you pray for the listener for us?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, Lord, you know, we come to you really trusting in your goodness and your mercy, in your grace and your love, especially just that knowledge that you love us. And we may not feel that, but we know in our hearts that you do love us and that you, in the end, have the best in mind for us. And Lord, however we deal with this, whether we're actively lamenting, whether we're having a conversation with you, whether we're, you know, turning our backs at this moment, we'd ask that you just be the hound of heaven and that you continue to provide that breakthrough that can reorient us toward the love that you have for us and reignite the love that we have for you. And we just thank you, Lord, for your faithfulness and your love.
Amen. Amen. Thank you so much, Dr. Everett Worthington, for being so vulnerable, for sharing from your heart, your process, and for all you've done to help us with forgiveness and to get healthy as a body.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Oh my gosh, y'all, God is so good. Isn't it interesting that my journey and Dr. Everett's journey had overlaps but differences? Where did you find yourself in this podcast? Where did you find yourself? This is such a hard topic, and yet it's so necessary because if we live long enough, we're going to be in a situation where we experience these feelings, even if it's not the same exact situation. I want you to take care of yourself. I want you to make sure you stay hydrated, nutrition. I want you to get a good night's sleep. I want you to get some movement. I want you to spend time with Jesus. Work on your self-care, because if you're dealing with these issues, you need your self-care. You need the floor of your mental and spiritual health to be strong. I love you, and I'll see you in all the usual places.